タラッタッタッタッタララタラッタッタッタッタララタラッタッタッタッタララタタララタラタラタラタタ。
Hello and welcome. I'm Helen.
And I'm Caroline.
And we love to sew. This is a podcast for makers where we talk about sewing a handmade wardrobe and bring you interviews with inspiring creatives and small business owners in our community.
Today we are chatting with Tanya Hughes, contributing editor for the Curvy Sewing Collective and blogger behind Mrs. Hughes. Tanya loves to sew retro and historical clothing and thrives on hunting down vintage patterns and materials. She shares her thoughts on sewing what you love and looking to the past for inspiration.
What's your favorite decade?
The 70s. What about you?
The aughts.
The what?
The aughts. You know, like 2000 and 2010.
That does not count, Helen.
I'm really into velour pants with things written on the butt.
Juicy.
Juicy. Hello, Tanya. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Hi, Helen and Caroline. My name is Tanya Hughes, and I blog at Mrs. Hughes, and it's a little confusing, but it's also my name, Tanya Miley, which is my middle name, so Miley.com. I live in California in the Sierra Nevada foothills near Yosemite on a cattle ranch.
Oh my gosh, we read on your blog about your dogs and your cats and your ranch, and it all sounds just lovely.
It is. It's a lot of work, though. Like, I've been out gardening all morning and working with the plumber to fix a bunch of stuff, and it's just always something broken or something to fix.
Not always idyllic ranch lifestyle.
No. And hopefully my dogs don't run around and bark during this.
Oh, if they do, that's fine. It's ranch realness.
Yeah.
So, Tanya, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your sewing journey, when and how you learned to sew?
I've pretty much been sewing all of my life. I spent a lot of time with my grandma because my grandparents lived right next door. Actually, the house that I lived in was my grandparents. And then my house, which is my parents' house, was, you know, right next door to it on our ranch. So I spent a lot of time with my grandma, and she was an avid sewist. She wouldn't know what sewist means, but she was a seamstress. She taught me how to sew by hand. And then when I was about 10, I think she started letting me use a sewing machine. And then I got into 4-H and home ec. And all through that, my mom was also helping me, but I think it was mostly my grandma who taught me all the fundamentals. And then I did a lot of sewing and learning on my own through books and watching videos. And I've learned a lot from blogs and a lot of learning how to do things on my own, too. So, you know, it's a long journey. And I think I've gotten to be a pretty good sewist now. I know I'm better than my grandma was when she taught me. So maybe if that's what you aim for, I think I've achieved that.
Better than grandma. That's a good goal to have, I think.
Well, she did things like an old way, and she always had me cut out patterns with the pinky and shears, and I really hated doing that. And then she didn't have a serger, so she didn't know how to finish seams other ways. Or she did, and she didn't show me. She must have, because I mean, I have her fabric stash and it has all her notions, and she has seam binding and everything, but I don't know, I hated using her shears. You know, having the new ones that I have, the Kai ones, I mean, they're like cutting butter, and it's so much more pleasant having tools that are razor sharp and work than, you know, trying to use these old shears that are just, I don't know, just a pain.
Yeah, no kidding. I know my mom was really jealous when she came over to make a pair of Hudson pants with me, and she saw my rotary cutter and my cutting mats and how easy I can cut things out, and she was just blown away. She's like, this is not how it was when I was sewing.
I know. And being able to use a serger to finish your seams and everything just looks so professional. I don't know. It's just amazing. I wish I would have had that stuff when I was a kid.
Yeah, but you got the other end of the spectrum, which is learning to sew by hand, which is an invaluable skill. So,
yeah, they wouldn't let me use a sewing machine. I think they thought I was going to hurt myself or something. And my mom, I don't know, I still haven't used my mom's sewing machine. And I mean, you know, I'd sneak in and try to use it one time while she was gone, and she she got upset because she thought I'd hurt myself with it. So I think that's why I did a lot of hand sewing, and I would make, you know, doll clothes and little pillows, you know, the things you make when you're a kid and when you're learning to sew.
So you mentioned that your grandmother had a ranch next door to where you live now. So did you grow up in the same area that you're living now? Have you been there all your life?
Yes. It's not two ranches together. It's just one family ranch with, there's three houses on it. I have lived here all my life, but I went away for school and I've lived in other states. So, I mean, I haven't lived here continuously, but I've been a resident and, you know, I've been here since I was born. So now I live here. I assume that's a lifelong resident.
That is amazing. And we also read on your blog that you had an academic career path as an anthroarchaeologist. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, I have degrees in archaeology and anthropology, and I'm a trained archaeologist. And I also have a background in American Indian history and culture, ethnography, and museum studies. And I was pursuing that for a while, but a lot of the work that you, because I applied for a lot of jobs, a lot of the jobs available are itinerant, and a lot of it involves working out in the field and basically digging ditches, and it wasn't really for me. And I was working towards a PhD, because I have a master's, but kind of got sidelined. So I don't know if I'm going to go back into it, because I'm not really enthusiastic about it at the moment. So I'm not sure if I'm going to go back into academia or not. But it's just like you envision something that's really different from reality, and wanting to stay here in the Sierras, it's difficult to find jobs, and you have to move, you know, where the jobs are when you're in that career, and there aren't very many of them. So I think I just kind of veered off course with that, because it's been 6 or 7 years now since I was into archaeology.
Wow. Yeah. And you mentioned working out in the fields, doing that kind of work. And I, after, you know, following your blog for many years, I cannot imagine you out in the field in your beautiful dresses and your heels or your costumes. I mean, yeah.
No, I would definitely not wearing dresses out there, because I did a lot of field work in South Dakota and Georgia. So a lot of bugs down in Georgia, so snake boots and a lot of bug spray. And I don't know, I really don't like doing work like that. I like artifacts a lot and working inside. So I volunteer as a docent at a local museum right now. That's more of the path that I prefer, is, I don't know, being inside and looking at things and curating things instead of finding it.
I can see that kind of being in line with what you studied, and it's great that you can do that in the city that you live now. You mentioned that there's like a history of sewing in your family, and I love that. I would love to know when you discovered the indie sewing community and when you started your blog.
It was around the time I was sewing my wedding dress. So that was 2009, 2010, because I worked on my wedding dress for, I don't know, from concept to finish, probably like a year. And, you know, just searching for things online and coming across blogs. And eventually I came across some, you know, non-wedding sewing blogs. And it was just really amazing. I mean, I think I looked at everyone's blog I came across and looked at their sidebar to see who was on their blog roll. And I read, you know, anything I could find, because it was just so amazing what people were creating. And it really inspired me to start sewing my own wardrobe, because before then I was sewing a lot, but it was just mostly Halloween costume and a formal event and some summer dresses, you know, and I never really got into it until I found the sewing community online. And now I have hardly any clothes that I've bought, because I make everything.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about your blog, what they can find on there, what sort of things you like to write about and share?
Well, I do a lot of vintage sewing. So when I talk about vintage sewing, vintage patterns and vintage reissue patterns, which are two different things, because a vintage pattern is a true vintage, whereas a reissue is what a pattern company, you know, they've reissued an old pattern, and they're not always the same. And then there's the vintage inspired patterns, which, you know, they're usually based on an original design. And those are the patterns that I like to sew the most. And I also mix in, you know, some contemporary ones. And like, I made some cashmere at Ames jeans and a Harrison shirt about a month or so ago. And I just altered those to be more like casual 1950s style. So, you know, you can alter modern patterns and make them more retro. So those are the things I really like to do. Most of my sewing is probably 1920s to 1970s. I mean, I do have some more contemporary things on my blog, but what I really like to do right now is more of the older 1940s, 1950s styles.
And what is it about sewing from a past decade that inspires you?
I have always loved vintage styles and historical styles. And I don't know, for some reason, I thought that I couldn't wear those things. And when I decided to start sewing those, I think it was before Mod Cloth and these other retro clothing companies came into effect. So there wasn't really much available, but there were patterns to make those. And so that really intrigued me. And I just started sewing. And I don't know, I can't stop sewing that stuff because it makes me feel good to wear it. And I think the styles that I make, I think they look good on me. And I don't know, it makes me feel unique, different. I mean, you can take vintage sewing as far as you want. You can wear accessories like hats and shoes and do your makeup, and you can be totally vintage, or you can be kind of mild, which is what I do mostly on a regular basis, because I don't really want to look like I'm wearing a costume. So you kind of straddle that point between, you know, your everyday clothing and being wearing a costume, which is what I don't want to do unless, you know, I'm actually going to an event where I'm wearing a costume.
Yeah, and you do sort of bridge that line really, really well, because you share makes that are a little bit more casual on your blog, where I could really picture you wearing them, you know, on the day to day. But then you also share these amazing historical costumes. And one of the things that we wanted to ask you was, when do you have the opportunity to wear those projects? Do you have like events or things in your town where people get together and kind of wear those historical garments?
I'm a member of the Greater Bay Area Costumers Guild. So they have a lot of events throughout the year where you can wear, you know, costumes from many different eras. So I go to those events sometimes. And my favorite event, although that's 1920s, which is kind of like costuming light is what I like to call it, because I've been sewing 1920s dresses for several years now. And I just started doing later periods about a year or so ago. And we have the Art Deco Society of California. So we have the Gatsby Summer Afternoon in Oakland. That'll be coming up in September. And they also have a ball, so you can wear 1920s clothes. Most of these things are in the Bay Area, not around where I live. So that's a couple of hours away. And they also have some other reenactment events in the Bay Area if people wanted to join those. And here at the museum, I can dress up and go as whatever I want. Like last week, I went in 1920s, and the week before I went in 1880s. So, I mean, it's really fun being able to wear those outfits out.
Wow, that is so cool. I'm sure people going to the museum must love seeing you in your costumes. I'm curious, does your husband also dress up with you when you go to these events, or does he come along? Do you sew for him, that kind of thing?
He always comes to every event I go to, except for at the museum, because he's working. And yes, he does dress up. And that's usually why it takes me longer to get ready for an event, and why I don't have as many historical costumes as I could, because I also sewing his costumes and putting those together.
That's awesome. Do you ever share those on your blog?
Yes, I have one outfit that I made for him, but this other one that I made recently, which is about late 1890s, 1900s. I haven't shared that one. I haven't shared my outfit either, because I'm running really behind on taking blog photos.
Aren't we all? So So I'm really curious to know, like, you sew all these costumes and some of them are quite involved, maybe a little bit more voluminous or more pieces involved. How do you take care of them and store them and keep them safe so that you can wear them to these special events?
I hang up most of the dresses in a closet and the undergarments, because I also make all the undergarments for a specific period. I just put those in drawers, and those are easy to care for, the undergarments, because they're just made out of cotton, mostly muslin, some lawn. So I can just wash those and, you know, just put those away. The beaded velvet gown that I made, that has to be stored in a box. So that's stored with acid-free paper in a museum-quality box, because it folded up, because it that one can't hang on a hanger because the beading will bring it down and beads will probably come off and it'll probably have sloping shoulders or something.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's like a real professional costume storage box.
Yeah. Like, how did you learn how to store a beaded velvet dress like that? Like, are there any resources online that you could point our listeners to if anyone else out there is looking to sew some more intricate costumes and store them properly?
I actually learned that in school, because that was part of my museum studies program. And I spent a lot of time in museums learning how to correctly store things. I know that they talk about how to store items in the We Sew Retro Sew and Tell group on Facebook. They often talk about how to care for items. But yeah, most of what I learned in school.
Awesome. And do you have a favorite costume that you've made?
Oh, that would be the gown that I just talked about. That's a 1920s Egyptian revival gown made out of silk velvet and rayon velvet, and it has hand beading all over it.
Wow. And you did all the beading yourself?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. We'll have to put a link to that in the show notes. I remember when I saw that one and it blew me away. It's absolutely stunning.
It was a dream to make, because I always wanted to make one, because a lot of the times when I make things, it's not really so much me wearing it. I mean, of course I want to wear it, but it's like the goal of creating it and being able to create it, being inspired by something to want to recreate something. Although that one, you know, I didn't use an original garment for inspiration. I used several different ones and just kind of came up with my own design. I love wearing it too, because it's lined with silk, so it just feels really good. It's heavy, but I mean, you would think so when it has a lot of beads on it. I don't even know how many beads are on it, 'cause to count that would, I just kept buying beads and adding them to it. I mean, I was still adding beads to it a week or two before, so I have no idea how many hanks of beads I bought for it.
So how long did it take you to make this costume?
Let's see. I wore it last year to the Art Deco Preservation Ball, and that was in April. And I think I started it like January of last year, so it might have taken me 3 months. And I pretty much worked on that all the time, but I really enjoyed it, so it didn't really feel like it was taking forever, except towards the end, because it has a lot of triangles on it. It's a geometric beadwork design, and I got really tired of doing all the triangles, and I was happy to finish those.
Oh my gosh. I mean, you say 3 months, that probably would have taken me 3 decades, but I can only imagine.
That's the most involved garment that I've made so far.
Wow. It must have been so much fun to wear it and show it off at the ball.
Yeah, I wore it there, and then I wore it to costume college last summer. So it got to be worn twice, which is pretty good, I think, for a costume, because sometimes I only wear something once.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about that? Does that ever kind of weigh on your conscience, the fact that you might only wear the pattern once or the garment once?
Sometimes. And sometimes it feels like you're just making something to wear it once. But as I getting more into costuming, and I meet a lot of other costumers, they rewear their outfits and they change things around. So I can imagine myself doing that in the future. And now that I'm a museum docent, you know, I can go up there wearing these things. So that's more interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you have to kind of shift your mindset, you know, to think about the fact that you're doing it for the love of making the garment, and the wearing it once is nice. And it's great that you get to wear it once or twice. But really, the whole point was the creation of the thing.
Yes. It's just, it's the goal of of being able to make something that you, you know, you dreamed about and you want to have, but, you know, you're not going to ever be able to buy it and much less wear it. So, you know, just doing it is fun. I wouldn't do it if I didn't enjoy it. If I didn't enjoy the process of making it, I wouldn't be making anything. So that's part of it. And I have a lot of goals of dresses that I'd like to make. Some of them inspired by historical costume and some of them reproductions of those. And it's just fun for me. And, you know, learning to do something new and or using, you know, a technique that I already learned how to do, but have, you know, don't do it very much. It's just, that's a whole, my whole reason for sewing and creating.
Do you ever go off script and draft your own patterns? Or are you always working from a vintage pattern to start with?
I rarely ever draft anything. I don't know if it's, I'm scared to do it because it seems like when you resize a pattern, it's almost like you're redrafting it yourself. But I just prefer having the pattern to work with and changing it around if I need to. Maybe if I get more confident in pattern drafting, I'll do something someday, but I like patterns.
So I want to talk a little bit about your collection of fabrics and notions and patterns.
I love vintage fabrics and I spend a lot of time thrifting and antiquing, and my husband and I are thrifting and antiquing almost every weekend. We also go to antique fairs and I spend a fair amount of time looking on eBay for stuff. So vintage fabrics are like the holy grail when you're hunting for things like this. So those are really hard for me, at least here in California, to find out in the wild, which would mean, you know, at a thrift store or antique store. So I very rarely find vintage fabrics out in the wild. I buy most on eBay and through Mayna Make This Look on Instagram. She has a vintage fabric store. So that's where I get most of my fabrics from. And I really love sewing with them because not only are you reusing something that, you know, someone had in their stash or I mean, if it was at a thrift store, someone didn't care about, but if you use both a vintage fabric and a vintage pattern, it's almost like you're making a true vintage dress, which for me, trying to find a vintage dress, that natural vintage dress that fits me would be really hard because most of them are small. And so, you know, it's just like you're making something, you're making your own vintage, which I really love to do. And vintage notions, besides, you know, being cheap if you find them at a thrift store, a lot of them are very well made and you can find some more interesting things and also things that are really hard to find right now, like covered buckled kits and things like that. So I have a lot of that in my stash.
And I can imagine also that the appeal of these vintage fabrics and notions must be just that there's like a story behind them. Do you ever think about who may have owned these in the past and sort of dream about what that story might have been?
Yeah, I think about it and I wonder why they didn't sew it. But then I look at my own fabric stash and I'm like, well, I haven't sewed everything in my stash either. So they probably had a stash too. Most of the time, I don't know where the fabrics come from. So I have no idea what the story is and, you know, who purchased it or why. For a dress that I made a few months ago, but I'm actually going to put it on my blog soon. That's made from vintage 1920s sheer wool. And that came from a store that somebody must have bought the estate of in Michigan. So that was interesting finding out about that. And that was on a bolt. And the bolt is wood and it's small. It's a lot different than a new bolt. So that was, you know, really interesting having that. And it's a little piece of history. And, you know, I sewed it up and I wore it. So, I mean, it's like I have my own vintage dress, except that I made it.
Yeah, I love that you are able to create these true vintage pieces on your own. And I can totally appreciate the fact that it's difficult to find those items like in stores, even in thrift shops, you know, at your size, because they do usually come in really small sizes. So can we talk a little bit about that? Because I imagine vintage patterns also don't necessarily go into like the larger size range. Is that something that you found to be true?
Yes, most of them that you'll find are going to be 32 to 34 busts, sometimes up to 36 or 38. They did make vintage patterns in larger sizes, and the largest one that I found is a bust 50. And whenever I see those, and I've never seen one, you know, out in the wild, I always have bought those on Etsy and eBay, the larger size ones. The smaller ones are much easier to find, and I will grade those up myself if I really like the style, because it's kind of a pain grading up like 10 sizes or more. And like I said before, it's pretty much redrafting a pattern. I try to mostly sew from vintage reissues because it's easier, but vintage patterns, if it's really something that I want to work with, like I made a patio dress and I couldn't find, you know, any new patio dress pattern. So I took a 32-inch bust and I resized it to 48. And luckily it was an easy pattern to work with and it worked out pretty well. So I amaze myself sometimes when it happens to work out like that.
Yeah, I love that you kind of talk about grading up patterns and make it feel a little bit more approachable and achievable to sewists out there. You're also an editor and contributor for the Curvy Sewing Collective, is that right?
I've been with the CSC since we started it in 2014.
So can you tell our listeners about the CSC? We haven't talked about the Curvy Sewing Collective on the podcast for a little while, so I'd love it if you could give them like a little rundown of what it's all about.
Okay, the Curvy Sewing Collective, it was started by Jenny Rushmore and Mary Danielson Perry. And they put together a group of bloggers back in, and that was 2014, and approached Colette. This was a group of plus size bloggers, and approached Colette because that was the time when Colette was expanding their sizes. So we put together a plus size blog tour with Colette, and we decided that it was fun, and there weren't many plus size sewists blogging at that time. So we decided to form a collective, and there was six of us at the beginning. We have a lot of people leaving and coming, you know, becoming new editors because, you know, life changes. And we made a website. I'm the web admin. So T and I, we created the website and it's evolved into a community. And we have a community group on Facebook and we have a presence on Instagram. We're not on Twitter. So it's been really fun. Starting that, a little overwhelming, but back when I started blogging or sewing blogging, it was really hard to find any plus size bloggers. I mean, I didn't even think there were any out there until around the time that we started that. So I think that we've inspired others to start taking photographs of their makes and sharing them online, which can be a little scary. I know when I started my blog, I was kind of scared about it because I was like, you know, I don't look like any of these other bloggers that are out there. So I don't even know if anyone's going to want to see me, you know. But I just thought, well, I want to share what I'm making. So I'll take pictures and I'll post them. And maybe somebody will read my blog. And it turned out that other people were. And people have told me over the years how I've inspired them. And they like to see me sewing a pattern before they do, so they can see what it looks like on a body similar to theirs. So I mean, it's been really fulfilling starting the CSC and continuing on with it. And it's evolving into different things. Having the community group, I mean, everyone can, you know, ask a question and get an immediate answer on there. And I think that it makes a lot of plus size sewists feel better about themselves and get advice on how to alter patterns and make things look good. And they can see what other patterns, what plus size patterns look like on other people.
Yeah, it's a really, really wonderful community, and it's amazing how much it's grown. And it just shows, you know, how much interest there is in the curvy sewing community for more plus size patterns and for more information about how to grade up and things like that. So the Curvy Sewing Collective is a great resource for any of you curvy ladies out there who are looking for some support in your sewing. Tanya, I would love for you to help us out and give our listeners some tips on what they can expect as far as alterations, if they need to grade up a pattern, or maybe for new sewists who are outside of the size range, how they can approach grading up a pattern.
On the CSC and on my blog, because I do have some of the grading tutorials on my blog, but most of them are on the CSC. That can help you, and you can find out what method works best for you as far as resizing a pattern. Now we're lucky enough to have patterns that go up into, you know, upper size ranges. So it's easier if you're a beginning sewist for on that. And I don't do this. Maybe I should do this alteration, but the FBA, the full bust adjustment, seems to be the most common alteration. So we have a lot of FBA tutorials on the CSC. I do a lot of the sway back adjustment to the back bodice of my dresses, because back there on the waistline, I guess it's because of my large butt, or, you know, the area back there, it kind of gets folds in the fabric on the bodice. So you take a little wedge out of that, and that helps eliminate that back fold. There are a lot of tutorials for different alterations that you might do. I mean, the sway back, that's the one that I usually do in the full bicep adjustment, because usually sleeves are smaller than my arms. I don't really do much more for patterns than those for my body shape, but the CSC covers a lot of different areas that you might need to work on if you want to have your patterns fit better.
Thank you. That is awesome. We'll definitely include some links in the show notes for our listeners. I wanted to ask you, I mean, you've been blogging about sewing and about your garments for a really long time. You know, you're an editor on the CSC. Would you say that sewing has changed your relationship with fashion and maybe even with your body through talking about it online?
I know that it makes me feel better about my body. I mean, I list my measurements quite often in pattern reviews on the CSC and on my blog. I couldn't imagine telling anyone before that what my measurements were, much less, you know, making a swimsuit and posting it online. I think it makes me feel a lot better about myself, and, you know, creating something that fits me, it's made for me, instead of having to buy it at a store.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's inspiring for a lot of people out there who are just on the other side of their computers, just reading and seeing the photos and all of that, just to have a person online to relate to that's maybe more their size. So I definitely commend you for, you know, putting yourself out there like that over the years, because I'm sure it's helped a lot of people feel better about themselves as well.
Yeah. And when you sew, the sky's the limit. You can make whatever you want. I mean, you're not limited to what they're selling in the stores. You can make whatever you want, whatever size you want. I mean, it just takes your time and your effort to create it.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about vintage patterns, because you have an Etsy shop where you sell vintage patterns.
Well, it started because I inherited my grandmother's stash, and then my mom, I mean, I didn't inherit my mom. She just gave it to me. And my mother-in-law also gives me part of her stash. So I had all these patterns, and I didn't want all of them. I took out what I wanted, and I set those aside, and I put those in my shop several years ago. And then as I go thrifting and antiquing, and I see patterns, I'll pick them up. And I've heard a lot of horror stories about, you know, just throwing vintage patterns out with the trash because they think they're useless. So sometimes it feels like I'm saving them and passing them on to other people, because I know a lot of people in other countries don't have the opportunities to go out and find vintage patterns on their own, so that they could buy some from me. I try not to sell them for too much, but, you know, it's got to be worth my time, because I have to go through the pattern, I have to count all the pieces, I have to list it. So, you know, of course I have to sell it. So in one way, it's a way to save things and, you know, resell things that I don't want, and make a little money, of course. And I do have a lot of patterns that I should be putting up there, boxes of them. I guess I'm not that committed to it because they're not online, but eventually they will be.
Oh my God. I just love that you're going around and saving all these patterns from the landfill and getting them out there to sewists who we know will appreciate them. So I think that's an awesome thing that you're doing.
I don't collect everything. It's got to be 60s or prior, unless it happens to be in a larger size, because those are more difficult to find. I will pick those up, but I kind of ignore 80s and 70s patterns and 90s. Unless they're like a Vogue Couturier or something like that, I will pick those up. Because I wouldn't say I save everything, because some of those decades aren't really worth my time, although a lot of people do like to collect those as well.
I'm wondering, is there a definition for a vintage pattern? Like you mentioned that 60s or prior for your purposes in collecting, but you know, as the years go on and you know, the past gets further and further in the past, you know, at what point do you define, you know, 80s and 90s as vintage patterns, or are they already at that point?
I think that it's like late 80s now for vintage, maybe even 90s, the definition, and anything previous. So I've seen the 1920s be categorized by antique now. So
wow.
I guess that's how you define it.
I mean, I guess it's almost 100 years ago. So
yeah.
Oh, boy. Oh. Other than the specific decade of the pattern, is there anything else that you look for when you find these patterns in thrift stores? Do you open them up and check them in the store?
Yeah, I do. If they're really cheap, I'll just buy it. Even if it's just an envelope, I will rarely leave them behind unless they cost a lot. It's not worth it for me unless I'm going to put it in my own collection.
Right. And do you check to see, you know, if it's been cut up already and that kind of thing?
Yeah. I open the envelope and I peek inside and see if it's uncut. Or there's a few times that I've found patterns that are, you know, they're pieces of have fallen out of the envelope and they're just like scattered, you know, because a lot of thrift stores, they don't care about patterns. You're lucky if they're in a filing cabinet for you to look through. So I have, like, I found a Vogue from the 60s and I was like, you know, it looks like there's some other pattern pieces mixed in with these others. So I did go through and I looked at the pattern numbers and I put the whole pattern together like that. And it was worth it to me that day because there wasn't much else there. But sometimes I won't spend time doing that. A lot of times they're all together, though. You know, I've looked through my own patterns that I've made over the years, and sometimes I don't put the pattern piece in. So I'm sure that the previous sewist, you know, sometimes she might not have either.
Yeah, that's totally understandable when I think about my pattern stash sometimes and how it can be in disarray. I can imagine that vintage patterns would be the same way. One of the things that we notice with vintage patterns, Helen and I, is that the models always seem to be so slender and it's difficult to kind of picture them on our curvier bodies. So do you have any tips on how we can kind of like look past that and envision the garment on a plus size body?
I always look at the line drawings on the back and I mean, those aren't going to be a lot different than a new pattern, the line drawing. So you could, if you already know what silhouettes look good on you, that's a good way to check it out. I mean, I always look at those vintage pattern drawings, you know, because they're usually a drawing, not a photo, and hope that I look like a tall, svelte person that's on the cover. And I know I'm not going to, but you know, I'm always thinking in my head, oh, I'm going to look like that. But no, of course, I'm not going to.
I love those like 6-inch waists and then the like triangle boobs of the really old patterns.
And the really long legs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, but the illustrations are really beautiful on a lot of those vintage patterns. And it's part of the fun of flipping through them as well. Yeah, I can totally see that.
They're nice to frame too. But I mean, because I'm a vintage pattern collector, I would never take the pattern contents out of the envelope if I was to frame it. I know that some people do that. I'm not talking about any sewists who are listening now, but other people might like the artwork on the front and just throw it all away and frame the envelope. But me, I would just put the whole thing into a frame.
Yeah, it's so true. It's kind of like cutting out the inside of a book to make like a little storage compartment or something, like just getting rid of all the stuff on the inside and just keep the outside.
It makes me cry to think about that.
Oh, I know. All those pattern pieces in the garbage. No.
And I also collect some other ephemera, like vintage pattern catalogs, which are extremely difficult to find, and magazines that I have going back to the 1880s. When I think about how, you know, some people will just rip those pages out to frame it or decoupage it, it just makes, that really makes me cry.
Oh, I love how you say decoupage like it's this like horrible thing. Decoupage. Oh,
I can't imagine.
How could they? No, but it's true. Like, I think that we could all stand to maybe think a little bit more about what we're doing before we like rip up these beautiful old vintage things, be it books or patterns or, you know, whatever you find in a thrift store, and think about maybe if somebody else would appreciate it and value it more than just having it, you know, on our wall or whatever.
Yeah. That's
something to think about.
But I also come from a preservationist standpoint. So, you know, my thoughts might be different than other people's.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a kid, I always tore up magazines. So, I mean, maybe other people think like that about vintage things too.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I guess everybody is entitled to their own opinion on the matter.
Yes.
Yeah. So we also wanted to talk about an article that you wrote for Seamwork magazine in 2016 about an eye disease that you have. Can you tell us a little bit more about this and how it's impacted your sewing over the years?
Yes, I have a degenerative eye disease that it involves my cornea. So my cornea is cone-shaped, whereas yours is round. A healthy cornea is round. And it affects the way light enters my eye. So I see things very blurry and double vision, and I have a lot of light sensitivity. I was diagnosed how long ago? Like 15 or so years ago, and I, not knowing what keratoconus was, you know, I thought I was just going to go blind. And it was a lot to deal with at first because it's a progressive eye disease. So my cornea was always getting thinner and changing, and it really affected the way I could see. And for a while, I could deal with it because one eye was worse than the other. So one eye was kind of healthy or a little healthier, and I was able to see. A few years ago, I noticed that my eyesight was getting really bad, and I wasn't able to see much. And I was just spent a lot of time squinting, and I had a lot of headaches. So I had already been dealing with my keratoconus with RGP lenses, which are small ones. And I didn't like wearing those because they were really uncomfortable. And I tried to continue wearing those, but they didn't fit because my eye was just too cone shaped. So I spent about 6 months going to specialists, and finally they came up with giving me scleral lenses, which are like an ocular prosthesis. And they're like a really large lens that covers your whole eye. And it's filled with, you fill it with saline solution. So it kind of vaults over my cornea, which are really steep because they're, you know, they're cone shaped. So it mimics a healthy eye. It makes my eye round. And when I got those, now I can see 20/20. And before that, it was really difficult to see. I mean, I spent a lot of time crying about it because, you know, losing your eyesight, it's really, it makes you really emotional, and not being able to do things that other people can do or that you've done before, and everything took a lot of effort. And once I got those lenses, my world changed because I could see all these things, and I didn't realize how much I was missing. And during that whole time, I was still sewing, which I don't even understand how, and taking blog photos. And I know I didn't even know what my photos looked like when I looked at them on my camera, because I would upload them to my computer and like really zoom in. And then I'd see, oh, I've got this stupid look on my face. But, you know, I couldn't tell that when I was taking pictures. So I don't know how I made it through that. But, you know, I feel really fortunate to have these lenses because I didn't have to have a surgery. And my eyes, because I go to regular eye appointments, you know, a few times a year. So my eye disease it hasn't progressed anymore. So it's about leveled off and hopefully won't progress anymore. So I'm able to see, which is, it just makes you extremely thankful.
Oh my gosh. We're so happy to hear that as well. And we can only imagine the feeling of just being able to see again after going through that for so many years and being able to actually look at your sewing in detail and look at your photos and just see the world around you. It must have been an incredible experience.
And when I got those, I started doing beadwork and embroidery, which, I mean, I already knew how to do, but it's really difficult to do when you can't see it. And just, I think I upped my sewing quite a bit when I was able to see everything. Of course, when you're looking at everything through a filter, because the way I can describe having my keratoconus is very advanced. So I wasn't able to have cornea cross-linking or any of those other things that people who have mild keratoconus could have. It's like, imagine yourself behind your windshield of your car and your car is covered with bug guts and, I don't know, your car is kind of freezing, your windshield is freezing and it's all blurry and icy and rainy and you can't see out of it. I mean, that's what it was like for me to look. I mean, still like that for me without my lenses on, to look through that. And then when I got my lenses, you know, it was like the windshield wipers came on and I could see through everything. It amazes me every morning when I put my lenses on because, you know, it hasn't gone away. I wake up and I have a blurry eyesight. I can't see anything. But, I mean, living with it prior to it getting really bad, it was like I didn't know anything else. I didn't know any different. I didn't realize how bad it was getting until it got really bad.
Yeah. Well, Tanya, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. We really appreciate you opening up about that. What should we talk about next? We wanted to get some tips from you about sewing with some fabrics and sewing certain things. So maybe you can tell us about sewing with velvet first, because I know you love to sew with velvet. You've made a lot of velvet things. So do you have any tips for handling this trickier fabric?
I think you can sew with any fabric, whether it's tricky or not. You just need to be careful. And velvet is one of them, because if you're not careful, you can crush it, which I've done before, because, you know, sometimes you're not thinking or you think that, you know, you're smarter than the velvet and the velvet will show you that, and when you wreck it. Because the biggest thing is when you press it and you don't really iron it is to use a velvet board, a needle board, or a towel. So it kind of, like you guys have discussed before, it just kind of holds the velvet fiber so you don't crush it. The other thing is pay attention a lot to the nap, so which direction it's going when you're cutting out your pattern pieces. You probably want to lay it all out, you know, single without a fold, just one layer. And you know, pay careful attention to which way the nap goes, so which direction, you know, the fibers are going, or, you know, it can look a little misplaced. But, you know, just sew it. Sew with it. I use a Microtex needle, stretch velvet, which I love it, but I hate it because I have to use pattern weights and it's all shifty and it moves around. So is silk velvet. Once you handle it, you can really create some beautiful garments that you just want to pet yourself. I mean, I've even worn my silk velvet dresses out and like people, strangers want to pet me. I mean, that's how wonderful velvet is.
Is this a selling feature of velvet? I'm not sure.
Strangers will pet you.
And sometimes I'm just looking, I'm like, okay, well, you know, those are sweet women. They're complimenting me my dress. They're not just some, you know, some stranger wanting to grope you.
I love that you mentioned the velvet, what is it called? The board, the needle board?
Oh, the needle board.
Because yeah. We've talked about it on the podcast before, but I've never actually seen one in person. I've only seen it like through Google image search. So is it like as scary as it looks in a picture? Because that thing looks like it could really injure somebody if you're not careful.
It does look pretty scary. If it bothers you, just use a towel. A towel will do the same thing. But don't go over and over the towel, because you know you can press your towel down too. It was actually a pattern test, so it was a wearable muslin when I made a velvet 1920s dress. It was decades of style pattern. I put fusible interfacing on it. And I don't know what I was thinking, because why am I putting fusible interfacing on velvet? But I did it. And it was, I don't know why I was surprised I ruined it, but I just decided I'm going to go with it. And I crushed the whole rest of the velvet. So I made a crushed velvet dress.
That's a good tip. You can save it if you crush your velvet. You just have to do it for all of it.
Yeah. Can't uncrush it. I tried. I tried to brush it and try and move the fibers, and it didn't work at all. I couldn't wash it. I don't think dry cleaning or anything else would have done any good. At least that was poly velvet, and it was just a wearable muslin. So when I worked with silk velvet after that, I was extremely careful not to crush it.
Oh, I bet. We'll have to link some of your velvet projects in our show notes so our listeners can check them out. You've made some beautiful things.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks for those great tips. So you also recently made some Victorian underpinnings, and that was another thing that we wanted to ask you about and get some tips about. But before that, can you tell us what intrigued you about sewing historical underthings and how you decided to kind of jump into that project?
Well, I've always wanted to make historical costumes. So when I started creating them, it was just a dream to do that. And they always say to start with the foundation first. So you need to start with, you know, all the underpinnings. So for a Victorian costume, this is a 1880s, 1890s one. You start with the shift, the chemise, which is the first layer, and then the corset, and then the corset cover, and I forgot the knickers. You have those on first. And all the petticoats. So when you make a costume, if you want to, this is not how everyone has to make a historical costume, because you could be historical costuming light, which is what I used to be, which is you just make the dress and wear whatever you want with it underneath. Or, you know, you can do some research and sew all the foundation garments like they would have worn, which takes a lot of time. And it took me quite a while to make all of those, including the corset. But it was really fun for me. But I was really happy to have a whole set so I could make the other outfits to go with it and not have to make the foundation garments for that period.
Yeah, I can imagine it would make a difference to the final look, particularly with some of those garments where the under pieces are a bit more structural and they're giving you that shape. Like you said, you want to start from the inside out, right? To get that shape of the outside garment perfect.
Yes, and you really need to have the corset, the right corset for the right period, and the petticoats, because they hold everything together. And besides that, without a corset, your petticoats get really heavy, because the corset helps support that. It holds your breasts up and gives you that period shape, which makes it look like you're from whatever period you're trying to represent, which is, the whole reason why many of us do historical reenactment.
Do you have any shops that you could recommend to our listeners where you can get the materials that you need for that?
It is difficult to find boning and busks and everything else you need. I bought a lot of mine on Etsy, but discovered recently that there's a local shop. Well, local is like an hour away, but a local shop that has all the materials I need to create a corset. There's a lot of them online, but I haven't bought from them, like Richard the Thread, and I think there's one Make Corsets. If you just search, you can find those. If you buy a pattern, and I would suggest to use an indie historical sewing pattern, not a big four, to make a corset. They have lists on the instructions on the pattern to tell you where to find everything you need, which is really helpful. I've only made one historical corset so far, so I'm not an expert. I have made other corsets, but they were, you know, with plastic and stuff from Big Four patterns, and they weren't historical. So I'm just learning on that. I'm getting ready to make it an 1850s, 1860s corset, and I really like making corsets. So I'm looking forward to doing that whenever I get around to it.
Cool. And as far as the boning goes for the inside of the corset, there's like a few different materials that you can use, right? Can you tell us a bit about those?
Well, there's the boning that you would go and find at Joann's, which is a plastic boning that bends with your body, and it conforms to your body, which is the opposite reason why you want to wear a corset. So I wouldn't suggest that. A lot of people use plastic zip ties, you know, from the hardware store, because those are those holding a little more. I haven't used those. I've only used steel boning for historical corsetry. And there's spiral steel boning too, which I haven't used either. And the other one is synthetic whalebone, which is also a plastic. And I'd like to use that. I don't know if I'll use it with my next corset or not, because I haven't started on that. When I made my historical corset, the pattern didn't tell me all of the supplies I need, because when I, you know, prior to starting a pattern, I like to read all about what I need, and I gather all the notions up. It was difficult to do with a corset, so I had to buy the boning and everything afterwards. I just had the busk. The busk is the center part, and I didn't even know how many grommets I needed because the pattern didn't say so. So, you know, that's a little confusing. I think making a corset is something that you really need to make a muslin with, you know, wearable mock-up, and then figure out all the supplies you need, and then go to the store if you're lucky enough to have one, or order them.
Yeah, that's a really good tip, because you're going to be putting a lot of work into a project like a corset. So making a muslin is definitely the way to go. And do you find that wearing all of these historical underthings is comfortable?
I wouldn't call it the most comfortable thing in the world. No, I mean, you're not going to lie about that. But it makes you feel like you're playing the part. It's not wearing a corset. I mean, there's a lot of misconceptions about it. It's not torture. I mean, if you tie your corset too tight, of course it's going to be torturous. You know, it's like wearing a back brace. If it's made to fit you, and when I wore mine, I wore it around the house a lot because the boning, mine is steel. So the steel started to conform to me and my shape, and it got more comfortable as I went along. But I mean, I dressed up and wore my corset last week, and I was really happy to get out of it, but I think I was most happy to get out of my boots, because I also had period footwear to go along with it. So I'm not going to lie and say that it's the most comfortable thing in the world, because it's not. And trying to drive in a corset, it's not comfortable. Riding, because my husband usually drives if we go to an event, I mean, that's a little more comfortable, but the comfort level is not good, but it's not as bad as you would think it would be. And if you make it yourself and make it to your body and your measurements, it'll be a lot more comfortable than if you went and bought one.
Yeah, that's fair. And I never thought about sort of breaking in a corset like you would break in a pair of shoes and wear it around a bit to let it form to your body. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it starts out being, because there's a lot of channels on a corset. And by the way, making a corset is, and it's not as difficult as it sounds. It's just a lot of sewing. If you can sew a straight line, then you can do it. After you wear it, it just starts to conform, and it gets curvy, and it follows your figure, your hips, your waist, and you can tie it tight and try and get smaller, but it's really there to hold you together and just give you that period silhouette that you're looking for when you're wearing your costume.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for those tips about corsets. I hope some of our listeners feel inspired to go out and try making one.
So we also wanted to ask you about the challenge that you organized called Dress Like Your Grandma, and you've been doing this for 2 years now. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about the challenge?
Dress Like Your Grandma, it's a vintage sewing challenge. So you take a photo, and most people use their grandma, but it doesn't have to be your grandma. It could be your grandpa. It could be someone you don't know, someone else's grandma. It could be a picture out of a catalog. You just take a photo and something that inspires you, and create an outfit inspired by that. And some people do literal interpretation of it and recreate the entire outfit. And some people do something that looks like it, you know, similar to that, to the photo in their inspiration photo.
So year two just wrapped up. So it's a little bit late for our listeners to participate this year, but you usually do it around April, March, April, May, right?
Yeah, it's, I've started it the last 2 years in March, and well, it's only going on for 2 years, but I usually extend the deadline because I don't know about you, but I always wait till the last minute to do things. And I think a lot of other people do too. So I gave our challengers you know, more time. But it, when I say it's a challenge, it's a challenge yourself. You're not competing against other people. It's just a challenge for yourself to create something like that. The last 2 years I've done my grandma and recreated outfits. This year it was a recreation, but I mean a different color, but it's pretty much inspired by what she was wearing.
We're definitely going to link this in the show notes because you just did a roundup of all of the people who participated this year. And the photos are incredible. I just love looking through
the
entries. Yeah, the side-by-sides. Like they've recreated the picture like almost to the T in a lot of them. And it's so much fun to look at and just some beautiful dressmaking happening.
I know, recreating the poses even. And I don't know, it's incredible to see the two pictures together. I mean, I love it because sometimes you don't really see how things are coming together until you see the two photos together. I really like some people next year to do some non-female inspiration photos. It seems to think that some people think that they have to be their grandma, has to be a female, but I mean, it could be anyone.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I like that it's open and you can kind of choose whichever person or image you want to recreate and really run with it. So that's awesome.
You mentioned that it's not really a competition, but you do have prizes and you select the winners at random, right?
Yeah, there are prizes for competitors. Well, I don't want to call them competitors, participants. Maybe that you can get a little something. I just use a random number generator and give everyone a number and go through like that. Happy to have Blackbird Fabrics as one of our sponsors.
Thank you. I'm so happy to sponsor this challenge. I think it's such a fun one. I love the sort of like retro inspiration behind it. And I remember last year when you first told me about it, it inspired me to go and look through old photos of my grandma. And I definitely did not participate, sadly, because I didn't get around to it. I'm a bit of a procrastinator, but I loved just like looking at those photos and getting inspiration from them. It was just really fun to be able to, you know, have that encouragement to do that. Because it's not often that we sort of dip into those old photographs, you know?
And some people, they have some really heartwarming stories where they've shared what they made with their family members. And sometimes they were able to share it with, you know, their inspiration person, like their grandma. Those are just incredible stories to hear. Because if you look on my blog, it has links to most people. Some people don't have social media or blogs, so you can't read about what they've said. But some people do, and you can go and click those links and read more about their story. And I can't imagine how that would feel to be able to share that. Like if I was able to share, my grandma's passed away, obviously. If I was able to share that with my grandma and see how she would feel about me recreating an outfit, it's unimaginable how that would just make you feel so wonderful.
Yeah, it's so touching. It's such a great challenge in that way. And I mean, there's so much history in it and there's so much history in sewing too. So it kind of just incorporating sewing with getting inspiration from, you know, old photos. I just really, really am into this challenge. So I encourage our listeners to go check out these roundups and the hashtags. And like we said, we'll link that in the show notes. We also just wanted to ask you kind of to wrap up, because you've been sewing for a long time. Do you have any words of encouragement for any of our listeners out there who are just getting started with sewing?
Sew what makes you happy and it feels like you. Anyway, instead of buying things in a store that's, you know, someone else's design, come up with your own interpretation and what makes you feel happy and what you want to wear, because I'm sure it makes everyone who makes exactly what they want just put a big smile on their face that they've created something and they're wearing it, whether other people notice it or not. I mean, you know it. You know you created it.
Yeah, it's so true. It's such a freeing feeling. And for any new sewists out there, I hope that you'll take that to heart. It's wonderful to be able to just create whatever is in your mind and really run with your own personal style.
And if you're sewing something and it's not enjoyable, I mean, don't think you have to finish it. Put it aside. Sew something else. Make something that's going to make you happy, because sewing is not supposed to be a job and it's not supposed to be torturous. It's supposed to be something fun and makes you happy.
Yeah, that is such a good point. It's kind of like when you pick up a book and you can't seem to get into it, but then you feel guilty about moving on to a new book before you finish the first one. But I'm you know, totally on board with like ditching a book that you're not into. And I completely agree with you. The same goes for sewing projects. If you are, you know, not into something that you're sewing, let it go or put it aside and move on to something else, because that could be, you know, what's like killing your sojo or something, right?
Yeah, I don't think you have to finish it. Of course, yeah. I mean, that's the goal, to finish it. I have some unfinished projects and some that are cut out that I've never finished, and maybe I'm never going to, because it's not inspiring me. So I'd rather just work on something that makes me happy.
Yeah, totally.
Well, on that note, do you have a sort of dream sewing project that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I've been working on everything I've dreamed about, but I have two in the works. Now, I don't speak French, so if I mispronounce these, Jean Lanvin, I never say it right. 1920s robe de style, that is in the works. It's in my head. I'm going to start that in probably a month, because I'm going to wear that in September to the Gatsby summer afternoon. So that's a 1920s robe de style with silk ribbon work. So silk ribbon, flowers all over it. And I've just been dreaming about having one of those for a long time. And I'm finally going to start working on it. And I'm making it out of organdy. So I do have some of the organdy. So I guess I have started collecting some of that. And the other one, which I may start soon too, is a Paul Poiret. It's a day dress, a linen day dress, and it has an Egyptian revival design. If you have the Paul Poiret book, it's a large one. It's in there, and it's white with red and embroidery, and it has Egyptian revival motifs on it. And I'm planning on recreating that, and I'd like to wear it this summer, but I don't know, sometimes plans don't work out. Maybe next summer. But those are my two dream sewing projects I'd like to do this year.
Oh, that is awesome. We really look forward to seeing those on your blog, and we hope our listeners go check you out, because your sewing is just so inspiring. Even if it's not a style that everybody is into, I think that your kind of commitment to the craft and just your, you know, your passion for sewing and creating these garments is completely infectious. So can you tell our listeners where they can find you online?
I'm on my blog. It's TanyaMaile.com. So Maile is spelled M-A-I-L-E. My first name, Tanya, is T-A-N-Y-A. So TanyaMaile.com is my blog. And I spend more time on Instagram. So I'm also TanyaMaile on Instagram.
Awesome. And we'll pop links to all of that in the show notes.
Tanya, thank you so much for coming on the show today. We really had a great time chatting with you.
Thank you. It was fun.
Okay, bye.
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 That's it for today's episode of Love to Sew. You can find me, Helen, at helenscloset.ca and Caroline at blackbirdfabrics.com.
We're recording today in sunny Vancouver, Canada, and you can get in touch with us and get links for everything we talked about in this episode at lovetosewpodcast.com.
And if you're loving the show and you want to help us out, you can support us on Patreon. If you contribute $5 or more a month, you'll get access to our bonus episode feed. Go to patreon.com/lovetosew for more info.
Our show is produced by Sam Humphrey.
Thank you, Sam.
And thank you all so much for listening. We will talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
At helenscloset.ca and Caroline at blackbirdfabrics.whocares.
I hate you.
Oh, I love you.
No, I love you. Okay.
Let's try that one more time.